This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. The federal government might soon intervene into Australia's energy market to ensure we have enough gas to avoid big power shortages and price hikes next winter, which might trigger business closures and damage the economy. The nation's competition watchdog, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, warns in an interim report published this morning that there will be a major shortfall in domestic gas supplies next year at a time when most gas produced locally is being sold off overseas for mega profits. For more on this story, I spoke earlier with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, just how big is this predicted gas shortfall for Australia next year, and what can the federal government do about it?
Well, good morning, Sabra. This much-anticipated report from the ACCC, commissioned back in June, a few weeks after the election, projects the largest supply shortfall of domestic gas since 2017. That's a shortfall that could mean even higher prices with demand outstripping supply. And the higher bills not only putting pressure on households, but adding to a crisis for manufacturers who are already reeling from surging bills, some who've already warned they might be forced to shut down. The report says Australia has, quote, relatively abundant gas reserves, but that the big gas producers are paying lip service to requests that they ensure domestic supply rather than selling it to more lucrative markets overseas. The ACCC says there's a real risk to energy security on Australia's east coast next year. So what this report does do is arm the government with a reason to trigger what's known as the Australian domestic gas security mechanism that would force exporters to ensure there's enough gas at home before it's exported overseas for big prices. Grattan Institute Director Tony Wood says a windfall profits tax would be another answer, but he thinks other triggers need to be exhausted before there's an all-out confrontation with gas producers as a result of the ACCC recommendations.
They support that the Labor government should go ahead with this review of the triggers that are already in place to see if they can be made more flexible and more responsive. How we're going to ensure that the prices that are already being seen in the international market don't continue to affect domestic consumers. I certainly would be one of those people who would argue very strongly that the government, given what we're seeing more of and no relief on these prices, should really look at as a windfall profit tax, because some of the producers are doing very well and making huge profits. So I think the Australian government should seriously be considering that for Australian gas and coal producers as well.
That's the Grattan Institute's Tony Wood. And Peter, the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, commissioned this report. How's he reacted, especially on whether exporters should be forced to keep enough gas for domestic use?
Well, Sabra, Jim Chalmers has jumped on this report, describing it as alarming, and he's urged gas producers to do the right thing by Australians. He's welcomed the ACCC's commitment to take more enforcement action where it sees concerns about a lack of competition in the market that would be hurting consumers and businesses. Dr. Chalmers says the federal government will be responding shortly. The big question is whether he'll wield a big stick in the form of that domestic gas security mechanism, which was created during the coalition government of Malcolm Turnbull, but is yet to be used.
Peter Ryan there. We now know the suggested wording for the proposed question and a commitment to hold a referendum before the next federal election on changing our constitution to set up an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice to parliament. Yet some are already concerned a no campaign will expose bigoted views and cause further harm to First Nations people. Carly Williams reports from Arnhem Land.
As the red dust settles on the Boongal ceremonial ground on the fourth day at the Garma Cultural Festival in Arnhem Land, 60,000 years of cultural knowledge is being generously gifted to guests by the Yungul people. The Northern Territory event saw thousands of First Nations leaders and organisations meet with government officials and non-Indigenous guests from the corporate world for keynote speeches and cultural events. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese flying in for an important announcement.
We are all here, eager to work with you to bring our commitment to Uluru to life. To see Australia answer that gracious, patient call for respect and truth and unity.
Beamed from the key forum at Garma Festival, the PM made clear Australia will be asked at a referendum if the public supports altering the constitution to set up an Indigenous voice to Parliament, essentially a body that'll inform government what policies are working for Indigenous people and what aren't. But the Prime Minister stopped short of announcing a date for the referendum. The reaction was mixed.
There is something in the air.
Enthusiastic, it was positive. He clearly has a lot of personal conviction around this.
Well, I started blubbering like a child. I'm like, oh my God, is this the new Paul Keating? Is this the new Lingyari? Like, this is a moment in time.
I kind of got up and left. So, yeah, obviously, yeah, because there was nothing, you know. There's no promises. Why is it taking so long for the government to actually give us a date?
There may not be a set date, but the road to referendum has certainly kicked off. Community members are already concerned any Vote No campaign is going to cause hurt to First Nations people. Worimi woman Lucy Brereton is an Indigenous liaison officer at a major bank. She says any non-Indigenous drive for a no vote could be damaging to groups like Stolen Generations survivors who have already suffered enough.
I mean, it would be traumatic. It's like the marriage equality campaign. You know, that was traumatic for a lot of our queer brothers and sisters. It's just not, it's not necessary, but it's probably going to be a part of this process. And thank God we are a resilient people because we've been through worse.
Lucy Brereton says the mood on the ground at Garma around the coming referendum campaign is cautiously optimistic, but there are concerns.
I mean, I think it was around Kempsey in 1967 that was the biggest no vote from memory. A lot of those views are older views. I hope they're older views. And I think we've got some really staunch Indigenous and non-Indigenous young people coming through now who will be voting. And that's kind of my, I don't know, positive silver lining outlook on those views.
The views around the referendum might be mixed, but one thing everyone agrees on was the contribution musician Uncle Archie Roach made to reconciliation. His death, a sad end note to a Garma festival considered one of the most important and successful ever held.
The children away.
The late Archie Roach, ending Carly Williams' report. Australia's controversial plans to acquire nuclear-powered submarines will come under scrutiny at a month-long United Nations conference which begins in New York today. Here's defence correspondent Andrew Green.
Good morning from Australia.
Almost a year after the historic deal was first unveiled.
And so Friends AUKUS is born.
The strategic partnership between Australia, the United Kingdom and United States is facing significant challenges.
It is a dangerous precedent. It is opening a door which is currently closed to increasing nuclear threat and risk and military application.
Dave Sweeney is a Nobel Peace Prize winning anti-nuclear campaigner with the Australian Conservation Foundation. Like many opposed to the AUKUS submarine plan, he's closely watching this month's United Nations review conference of the parties to the Treaty of the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, which begins today.
I would imagine that there will be very significant concerns raised about AUKUS. Those concerns will come from civil society representatives at the NPT review. But importantly, they'll also come from NPT state parties, like nations that have deep concerns about this.
One such nation is Indonesia. In a formal submission to the UN Review Conference, it notes with concern the potential consequences that transferring nuclear submarine technology could have for the global non-proliferation regime. China, which is expanding its nuclear weapons stockpile, has also made its opposition to AUKUS clear. Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian is speaking here through a translator.
The global strategic security environment has been deteriorating. The international nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation regime is confronted with grim challenges. There's a deep divergence in the area of peaceful uses of nuclear energy.
Tim Watts is the assistant foreign minister. He denies Australia is setting a dangerous non-proliferation precedent through AUKUS that other nations could exploit.
We recognise that NPT states parties will be closely following Australia's planned acquisition of nuclear-powered conventionally armed submarines under AUKUS. The NPT legal regime does not prohibit naval nuclear propulsion, and AUKUS leaders have made it really clear that we will carry out this project in a way that meets the highest possible non-proliferation standards.
That's Assistant Foreign Minister Tim Watts and our reporter Andrew Green. China's conducted live fire exercises and is ratcheting up its warnings to deter US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi from visiting Taiwan. Ms. Pelosi is heading to Asia, but she hasn't mentioned if she's dropping in on Taiwan, leaving observers to track her plane for clues. While some are concerned about China's warnings and a possible confrontation with the United States, many in Taiwan don't seem worried. East Asia correspondent Bill Birtles reports.
On Taiwanese news channels, the potential visit of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is receiving wall-to-wall coverage. She'd be the most senior American politician to visit the island in 25 years. Some Chinese government commentators have gone so far as to suggest her plane should be intercepted or even shot down. The extreme language is not the Chinese government's official position. But Beijing's fury over the potential visit has rattled nerves, although not so much among residents of the capital, Taipei.
I'm not across the details, but from what I've heard, it does sound like Nancy Pelosi will come here. As for China's intimidation language, I don't think people here are too fast. There's not much point thinking about conflict.
Yeah, we should more worry, but I think we still have to live our life.
Chinese threats are nothing new to the people of Taiwan, but Ms. Pelosi's potential visit has kicked off a huge campaign in Chinese state media warning against it and multiple live fire exercises. Over the weekend, China hastily arranged live fire drills off the coast of Fujian province opposite Taiwan. Last week, President Xi Jinping warned Joe Biden that those who play with fire over Taiwan will perish. With her plane landing in Guam last night en route to Asia, and with an event scheduled in Singapore tonight, a visit to Taiwan would be more likely later this week. Yu Bei Chen, a Taiwanese military commentator, believes they will head to Taipei.
Everyone's wondering if Pelosi will head to Taiwan, and we'll know very soon. But think about it. She's going to Japan, to South Korea, to Singapore and Malaysia. Will she have to fly past Taiwan? Of course she will. Will her plane land in Taiwan? I think she definitely will.
If it does go ahead, the presence of the woman third in line to the US presidency meeting Taiwan's president would be viewed as a further sign of US support for the island's democracy against a backdrop of rising Chinese pressure. If it doesn't go ahead, some might see it as wavering US resolve towards Taiwan and a diplomatic win for Beijing. This is Bill Birtles in Taipei reporting for AM.
The Australian government's being urged to step in and stop China from buying a company that controls a deep water port and airstrip in Solomon Islands, amid fears Beijing's trying to develop a military presence in the Pacific. An investigation by Four Corners has discovered a Chinese company's in talks to buy the island in Western Province and reveals details of how money from Beijing has been used to prop up the Solomon Islands Prime Minister, Manasseh Sogavare. Angus Grigg reports.
Surrounded by glassy waters and covered in lush tropical vegetation, Colinbungra in Solomon Islands is home to the country's only sustainable forestry plantation. Standing on the island's edge, the general manager of Colinbungra Forest Products, or KFPL, Edwin Schramm, explains how it also has one of the nation's best deep water ports.
It's exceptionally deep. You probably find that it's up to 40, 50 metres deep as you approach the wharf. It's a really, really well-suited natural port for big vessels to come in and berth.
Four Corners can reveal China Forestry Group, a state-owned enterprise, is in talks to buy the plantation, which would give it control of the island's assets and infrastructure, including the port. Colinbungra local Redley Vargo is worried about what a sale to China could mean.
Chinese companies have a reputation for bringing in their own labour. Is that one of your concerns?
I think that's one of our main concerns because overall we have always had our local labourers coming in. For us to see our people being sidelined in this way is going to be devastating and it's going to be morally wrong, I think.
The geopolitical consequences could be huge. In May, KFPL board members wrote to the Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong about the risk and strategic threats posed by any sale. It urged Canberra to step in and buy the plantation to boost ties with Solomon Islands and prevent China taking control of the port and airstrip and establishing a base. The Department of Foreign Affairs responded late last week, saying it would not be intervening. Dr. Anna Poles is a Pacific security expert from Massey University.
We do know that Chinese companies are often the vanguard of Beijing's state interests in countries and regions. And so in the case of Solomon Islands, certainly the Chinese commercial network is incredibly useful for Beijing in its pursuit of its strategic interests in Solomon Islands and in the region more broadly.
China's presence in Solomon Islands has grown rapidly since the country switched diplomatic recognition from Taipei to Beijing in 2019. Four Corners can reveal new details of how last year the Solomon Islands Prime Minister, Manasseh Sogavare, used money from a Chinese slush fund to maintain power as anger grew over his leadership. Documents show in August and December, Mr. Sogavare paid nearly $3 million Australian dollars from the Chinese slush fund to loyal MPs. MP Silas Tausinger received the first payment, but quit the government before the second.
So you're saying that the Member of Parliament can actually use this money for whatever they like?
Yeah, it's upon their discretion. It's you know, if they say school fees, if they say build a school or whatever with it, it doesn't matter.
Do you think this money helps the Prime Minister stay in power?
Well, he's stayed in power, hasn't he?
Four Corners emailed detailed questions about these allegations to the Prime Minister's office and followed up with phone calls and texts. We received no response.
Angus Gregg. Thousands of Australians sleep rough on couches and in cars every night because they have nowhere to call home. And today, Homelessness Australia is launching an ambitious plan to provide housing for all vulnerable people. The first step, within 5 years, to halve the number of residents experiencing rental stress and the number of those repeatedly turning to homeless services for help. And to achieve that, it says governments must invest in 50,000 homes a year, as Annie Guest reports.
Aww. The sound of her baby's heartbeat is sheer joy for Arok Deng at her 36-week pregnancy scan.
They grow so fast. I have only 4 weeks to go until I'm due.
In that time, the security worker is desperate to find a home. Arok Deng has always lived with her parents, but it's too crowded there to house the 26-year-old, her partner, and their baby.
I've been looking for a property for the last 3 to 4 months. I've been applying consistently, inspected about 35 houses. All you're getting back is a rejection after rejection after rejections. And as heavy as pregnant as I am, to be going around inspecting houses.
The chairwoman of the advocacy group, Homelessness Australia, is Jenny Smith.
That's the tragic circumstances that we're seeing in our community now, that it's not just people on our lowest incomes, but people who are in work.
But an ambitious plan to solve that is being launched by Homelessness Australia, proposing investment in 25,000 affordable rental properties every year for low-income earners, and another 25,000 for social housing for the most vulnerable Australians.
There is the opportunity for the federal government to tap into institutional investors like superannuation funds. Our superannuation funds invest in social housing in other countries, but the settings for them to do so in Australia haven't been there to date.
Jenny Smith also wants the federal government to increase the annual $1.3 billion allocated to the states for housing and tie it to delivering the plan. She says it would ultimately save money, given homelessness is estimated to cost at least $670 million a year. The proposal prioritises ending homelessness for Indigenous people and for women and children who are overrepresented among the 116,000 Australians homeless every night.
The biggest driver of homelessness in our community is women and children escaping family violence, and a choice between violence and staying with it or escaping that violence into poverty.
In a statement, the Minister for Housing and Homelessness, Julie Collins, reaffirmed the government's commitment to a national housing and homelessness plan, including acute crisis housing for domestic violence victims and support for Indigenous housing and veterans. The plan's key promise is a $10 billion housing fund, delivering 30,000 social and affordable homes within 5 years.
We really need to amp that up in order to tackle the very significant shortfall. At least 433,000 social housing properties short.
Jenny Smith from Homelessness Australia, ending Annie Guest's report. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Australian hospitals have never been so swamped by COVID-19 patients. So how many more waves will we need to endure? Today, epidemiologist Tony Blakely on why Australia's early success at keeping the virus at bay is now working against us. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.